I'm David Marcus, host of Drinks with the Deal, and today our guest is Joel Friedlander, a partner at Friedlander and Gorris in Wilmington. Joel, thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure, David.
So we're going to talk about your background on today's podcast, how you came to the law, how you shifted over time from a practice that was more focused on company side work to one where you represent plaintiffs in corporate litigation in the Court of Chancery, some of the cases you've particularly enjoyed working on, and then your scholarship and you're writing law review articles about some of the issues you litigate, but also issues, you know, related to Delaware law more broadly. So with that, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to the practice of law.
Well, I suppose I came to the practice of law most directly when, as a Wharton undergraduate in the 1980s, I realized I was not as facile with numbers as my classmates, but I was a better student of English and sociology. So when, after the stock market crash of 87,
Which was the fall of my senior year.
And I was interviewing for a bunch of investment banking jobs. And when I didn't get the ones I was particularly looking for, someone told me about the opportunity to become a paralegal at Scott & Arps. And they had just started up this program where they would pay for a chunk of your law school if you came back as a lawyer. And it seemed like an interesting thing to do, to see. I was interested in mergers and acquisitions, but to be inside a Wall Street law firm doing mergers and acquisitions work from a paralegal perspective.
And so talk about the paralegal experience. And you were on the corporate side of paralegal. You were not a litigation paralegal, correct?
Right. So I was, you know, working with the junior and senior associates in the M&A department. And it was a fascinating time. This was 88, 89. It was right at the time of RGR Nabisco and a lot of these giant deals. The conference rooms were busy all night. There was a whole shift of night paralegals. And if you said you were working late, that would mean 1 a.m. or 2 a.m. or later. It felt like it was like the center of the world for that time.
And at this point, there were no virtual data room. If any piece of paper that was going to be viewed as part of a due diligence process, that was physical paper that had to be handled by paralegals. It was a much more, at the lower level, I think, human capital intensive business than it is today.
Right. I actually have virtually no conception of how corporate lawyers practice or deal makers practice in terms of, I mean, sure, there was back then exchanging of drafts or merger agreements, I guess, by email or whatever. But yeah, the closings were in the conference rooms at Scott & Arps. Just the drafting of the tender offer materials were done in conference rooms, and the gatherings of the lawyers and the paralegals and the folks at different levels. It was all very much an in-person affair.
And so you then spent a year as a paralegal at Skadden and you went to law school, but you ended up going into litigation rather than corporate. So talk about your time in law school and how you shifted to litigation and ended up starting in Wilmington, at Skadden's Wilmington office rather than its New York office.
Sure. So I had no conception of becoming a litigator when I was in law school. I worked a summer at Jones Day in Cleveland after my first year, but it was sort of my default position that I was thinking of becoming a New York Wall Street lawyer. And I was a summer associate at Skadden for my second year, but this is now 91 and everything was dead. I mean, it was just the place was empty and there was very little activity. And I got some great advice from a couple of associates I had known from when I was a paralegal. And they said, hey, Joel, you know, you seem to be more interested in the law than most folks. So you should really be a litigator in our Delaware office rather than a deal guy in New York. And I thought that was great advice. And I got permission to spend the last 3 weeks of my summer in the Wilmington office, which I really enjoyed.
And then you ended up clerking for Jack Jacobs, who at the time was a member of the Court of Chancery and then was elevated to the Delaware Supreme Court.
Right. That was about a decade later that he became a Supreme Court justice. So I had taken a class with Chancellor Allen. Actually, Jack Jacobs was a close family friend of my fiance, then my wife at the time, and I clerked for him. And it was a quiet time on Chancery back then. There were five judges, but there was that had been the court had been expanded in the 1980s and all the hubbub over hostile deals. But then that was all gone and things were pretty quiet. And basically I spent my evenings and weekends writing a law review article. It was a very unhectic year.
But you were passionate enough about the intellectual side of the law to spend your spare time doing that.
Right. So I was trying to apply some sociological theory I'd learned in college and as an undergrad and to corporate law. So I had done that for constitutional law when I was for my law review note, which got published. And then I was applying the same professor's sociological theories to corporate law. So I wrote an article about the Time Warner case and the time culture concept and tried to take in the broad sweep of corporate law over hundreds or thousands of years and talk about that.
And so then after your year of clerking, you started as a litigator at Skadden in Wilmington. So talk about that. And then your transition to a much smaller litigation boutique.
Sure. So I was only at Skadden, as it turned out, for about a year and a half. Things, I'd say, were relatively slow. I mean, in the sense that there were so many lawyers had been hired and partners made in the 1980s, and there was less chancery work in the 1990s. So it was a time of attrition, and a lot of the Delaware lawyers started working on non-Delaware matters and matters around the country. And a lot of my time was spent on a school desegregation case. We had the State Board of Education as a client, and then there was city suburban busing in northern Newcastle County, and Skadden was retained to get the desegregation order lifted. So I spent a lot of my time on that case, as well as M&A cases like the Unitrin case, I remember, but I found it fascinating. It was a very busy time, and I worked pretty hard, but a lot of it was not on corporate law, as it turned out.
And then Steve Lamb, who was at Skadden at that point, a little older than you, and who later himself became a member of the Court of Chancery, started a boutique litigation firm. So talk about deciding to join him in as different a law firm as you could imagine from Skadden or a firm like Skadden.
Right. Well, it wasn't that different. But yeah, so I had this fatalistic conception that there was no way any junior associate at Skadden was going to get named partner because of the overhang of all the lawyers hired in the 1980s and the lesser amount of chancery work in the 1990s. So I was always thinking I'd be looking for the first opportunity to leave, a good opportunity. So when Steve Lamb said he was forming his own firm, I just knocked on his door and said, "Hey, can I join you?" And he said, "I told my partners that I wouldn't recruit at the firm. So can you come to my house on Saturday morning?" And I joined him. And so we were a two-person firm, the law offices of Stephen P. Lamb, Andy Bouchard, who had worked with Lott Skadden, joined a year later. So it was Lamb and Bouchard. And then Steve went on the bench in 97, and it became Bouchard and Friedlander. And the firm hasn't really changed since then. The names have changed, but the firm has just evolved from that same employer ever since 96, 97.
And so talk about the evolution of the firm and your practice. And again, a firm with, for the most part, 5 to 10 lawyers, you know, in that time.
Oh, we never made it to 10. I think we peaked at 6, but we tried to be like an elite chancery firm. We wanted to be the best firm in town at chancery practice and carry over everything we learned to Skadden for whatever matters came our way. Steve had followed the lead of another partner, Skadden, in the New York office, Stu Shapiro, who had argued and won Revlon in the Delaware Supreme Court in 85. He had started his own firm and Steve followed along. And so a lot of our cases were with Stu Shapiro. A lot of them were referrals from Skadden. And it was all very interesting work, but it was all on all sides of deals. Steve had been brought into this Disney litigation involving Michael Ovitz, which was a big deal 20, 25 years ago. And then when Steve went on the bench, I continued working on that matter. Oddly enough, as a very young lawyer representing Disney in that derivatives case.
Obviously, a lot of your classmates from law school at Penn spent their careers in big law. As you've talked to them over the course of your career, how has your experience professionally differed from theirs because you're just in a much smaller firm?
Well, I say back then, it was still at a time when a lot of Penn grads were in Philly firms and actually a relatively small number. I think, you know, went to New York. I had one friend ended up at Wachtell Lipton and then moved on from there. But I always just felt very privileged and fortunate to be just part of what was happening in Delaware and in terms of the kind of court of chancery matters and being sort of a real capital of Delaware law in the country. So I just felt really privileged to be a part of that, whether it's small firm, large firm.
And then talk about the evolution of your practice towards doing increasing amounts of work on the plaintiff side in corporate cases, the point where now that's almost, as I understand it, your entire caseload.
Right. So I think that understanding has changed over time. Like when I started, you could think of Skadden as a plaintiff's firm. For hostile tender offers, that was the place to go.
Because they were often on the bidder side. Classically in the 80s, Skadden was on the bidder side and Wachtell was on the target side.
Right, exactly. So for instance, like, you know, Unitrin was a situation like that. And then, you know, corporate control contests, you know, didn't really matter, plaintiffs, defendants, you know, proxy contests. I mean, that was all a pretty natural evolution from Skadden, even if it was, you know, smaller matters. So we were just doing interesting chancery work, whether it be presenting individual directors or officers or even a special committee. And a couple of contingent matters came to us almost randomly and haphazardly. And we just started doing that. But that was like a sidelight. So the business model was to pay the bills and, you know, make a living from the hourly side and then just see what happens, trying a plaintiff case or two or three.
And what did you enjoy about those cases as compared to what was then the bulk of your work on the corporate side, director in Delaware litigation?
Well, I think I always thought the main difference was temperamental more than anything else. I mean, just the idea of this pursuit and seeing what happens and not being wedded to the clock. I just like the pursuit. And I think a lot of it more than anything is to have the right temperament to do contingent work. It helps to have, I think, this conception that everything really truly is contingent and the case isn't over and you're not paid until the case is actually completely over and or until you actually got paid. I'm thinking of one example where we got a court order to pay us our firm a certain fee for a change of control in Broglio, and it was payable within 5 days. And on day five, the company declared bankruptcy. So I ended up being, I think, chair of the creditors committee and seeing this company through bankruptcy in Los Angeles. And then while they took an appeal of our fee award in the Delaware Supreme Court. So I just like that mentality. I just like the idea of it being contingent and trying to apply your talent and skill and seeing if you can make something out of a situation in which other lawyers probably wouldn't.
Talk about a handful of the key cases in your career. The cases that you've most enjoyed litigating or that are most memorable for you?
Well, certainly our case involving Activision Blizzard, where we had claims against Bobby Kotick, the CEO, and others regarding their restructuring transaction with Vivendi. That was probably our most successful case.
And what year would that have been?
So that settled right before trial, the end of 2014. And that was actually all relatively quick. I think that all started around 2013, actually. So it was done on a relatively expedited basis. Oh my gosh, my mind wanders to this case called Chaparral, which was a very small deal involving by Lukoil buying out the public stockholders for a company whose only asset was an indirect interest in oil rights in Kazakhstan. And that entailed posing some folks from Lukoil in London and then cross-examining one of them in trial and chancery and, you know, running around to Canada and Houston and London. That was a fascinating case that settled after trial. The Rural Metro case is probably the one I'm best known for, which is the first time on a Revlon claim that was taken to trial to a monetary judgment and then affirmed on appeal.
That was, I believe, about an $87, $88 million judgment, correct?
Yeah, with interest, it was 90-something, and we settled for other defendants for another, I think, around $11 million. So all told, it was about $107, $108 million collected. And I also put Boeing, more recently, the Caremark case involving Boeing's oversight of the 737 MAX, which settled after a motion to dismiss opinion a couple of years ago.
Talk about what you're seeing now in the Court of Chancery that is particularly interesting to you, either in terms of litigation you're working on or in terms of broader issues?
Well, anyone who knows me knows that the only cases I find interesting are the ones I'm litigating. So I tend to be not terribly interested in other people's cases, which is also, I think, by the way, psychologically important not to be too concerned about how other plaintiffs or lawyers are, you know, making money or not making money on their cases. We're a small firm. We don't try to be in the market for every deal or to get some percentage of the deal flow litigated by us. So we're picking our spots and pretty much just focused on our cases. There was this whole imbroglio earlier this year over these highly publicized decisions that then led to the new legislation. And that caught my eye over time. So that's the closest I've come to really closely paying attention to other situations around town.
As your legal scholarship suggests, you do have a really intellectual side. I mean, you clearly enjoy thinking about the law, but would you say that's almost a different pursuit or a different part of your brain from the cases you're working on, that you kind of segment them in a way?
Oh, sure. It's definitely a different pursuit. I don't think I'd even classify it as intellectual. I don't think I've thought really deeply about corporate law for about 30 years, but I do try to write about the law, not black letter law, but interesting things that have arisen, which generally are about the rule of law and their interaction with corporate law in some matter, or actually constitutional law. I wrote an article about how the partisan composition of our court system under the Delaware Constitution was unconstitutional under the First Amendment.
Just to clarify for listeners, the Delaware Constitution required essentially that there be a 50-50 balance between Democrats and Republicans on the state's three courts, and did not provide for the possibility of judges with no political affiliation or a different political affiliation.
Right. So this has been, well, something everybody in Delaware knows, and everyone, I think some people ponder whether it's constitutional, and no one ever said anything about it. But I decided to write something about it. So in 2016, I published a law review article entitled, "Is Delaware's Other Major Political Party Really Entitled to Half of Delaware's Judiciary?" Because that's the language of the state constitution. One major party and the other major political party gets the remainder of the judges. And that went up to the U.S. Supreme Court. Someone filed suit right after I wrote my article. I didn't litigate the case, but I did write a couple of amicus briefs in the U.S. Supreme Court. It got remanded, and then the state of Delaware essentially gave up upon remand and has agreed that provision is unconstitutional.
Talk about, you clerked for a judge, you've practiced with two folks who have gone on to have very impressive careers in chancery. Talk about the difference between being a litigator and being a judge, and, you know, why being a judge might or might not appeal to you or appeal to someone with your kind of interest in the law.
Well, it definitely did appeal to me. Thought about it all the time, applied, and the powers that be didn't really want me as a judge, which is also okay. So I had decided like a long time ago that it was more important to me to write about the law and say what I really thought and to get involved in certain ways and say and do what I really think. And if that is good or bad in terms of judicial prospects, so be it. So I was not picked, but I've been very happy to be a lawyer, to be writing about the law, to be teaching. I designed a course about stockholder litigation that I've taught at Penn Law and University of Michigan Law School, a couple of mini courses, did one at Harvard Law School and one this past winter at a law school in Israel. So I find a lot of fulfillment from practicing, teaching, and writing about the law.
Talk about your teaching and what you get out of that. And did you at any point consider becoming a law school professor full time?
I guess the short answer to that is no. I really enjoy more than anything else the actual litigation, the pursuit of the cases. And I see the teaching as an adjunct to that. I think to the extent my students find the class interesting, it's because I'm trying to bring to bear how we litigate cases and the practical aspects, not so much the super practical aspects, but just thinking through what makes cases win or lose and how that interacts with public policy and with black letter law. So the writing and the teaching are both, I've always thought of them as sort of sidelines to litigating.
And when did you start teaching?
Like the winter of 2019. Well, actually, I taught a semester at Widener back in 1998. I taught a class of equity that I picked up from Vice Chancellor Jacobs, who used to teach the class. And I think then Steve Land then suggested that I teach it instead of him. So I did that for a semester a long time ago. But in 2019, I did a little mini course at Harvard with Jesse Fried, and that helped propel me to teaching a class at the University of Michigan.
Finally, what do you do to decompress from the job? Or to a large extent, are the teaching and the writing the ways you re-energize yourself?
Yeah, I think it's more the latter. Look, I feel very fortunate that my practice is not something where I'm the one like juggling 10 to 12 cases and always like responding to a zillion emails. And so it's not like this nonstop hum of practice. So for me, but it's like taking depositions or writing briefs, writing complaints, making oral arguments. I mean, that's what I really enjoy doing. And it's the teaching and the writing are just really other ways just to engage myself in the law. So I don't really think of it as decompressing. It's more just, you know, additional things I enjoy doing.
Joel, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's been a pleasure, David. Thank you.
For Drinks with the Deal, I'm David Marcus.